This podcast has been prepared exclusively for institutional, wholesale, professional clients, and qualified investors only, as defined by local laws and regulations. Please read other important information, which can be found on the link at the end of the podcast episode.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Eye on the Market podcast for our annual energy paper. This year, the paper is called Electrovision. And before getting into some of the details, I want to talk a little bit about how this energy journey began. Around 15 years ago, once the smoke cleared from the financial crisis, I decided I wanted to understand energy at a much deeper level than I had. So I reached out to Vaclav Smil, who's one of the world's preeminent scientists. He didn't respond the first several times I contacted him. And finally, he said, "Who are you and why are you pestering me?" And I explained who I was and what I wanted to learn and what I had read. And he said, "Fine, if you really want to learn about energy, show me that you really mean it. Come up to Manitoba in February and we'll spend a couple of days, you know, with a blackboard and a pen." And so I did. And here is a picture of a sign that I took on my way to the hotel where I met him. It says, "Welcome Manitoba Moose." I guess people welcome moose in Manitoba. And we spent a couple of days going through some basic energy math. And for 12 years, Vaclav served as the technical advisor to this paper, and it was one of the most fantastic experiences I've ever had at JP Morgan in terms of being able to communicate and learn from someone like that. Vaclav is over 80 now and he's retired. We still communicate on a variety of topics. He's shared his recent essay with me, which he's allowed to share with you, and there's a link to it in the energy paper. I could never have done any of this without his original guidance, which taught me how to think about energy issues. So this year's paper is called Electrovision, and I don't think this is going to be a surprise as to why. The consensus path forward is electrification of everything, because if you can electrify it, you can presumably decarbonize it with wind, solar, hydro, battery storage, transmission, and possibly nuclear. And so the idea is let's electrify everything that moves. And in principle, from a mechanical engineering perspective, it can be done. But the obstacles are all related to things like physics and chemistry, cost, human behavior, and politics. So this year's energy paper goes into the details. I wanted to show you just a few charts from the piece, but it's a long piece like it is every year. It's got a lot of charts and tables and different sections. I'm just going to give you a very quick preview in this podcast/webcast. I'm showing slides here, so if you're listening, this might be the kind of thing that you want to, you can listen to it, but you can also watch it on the video if you go to the webpage where we post these things. So to be clear, the fossil fuel share of primary energy is falling. In other words, the share of global energy use from fossil fuels is falling, and it's falling at roughly the same pace that it fell during the 1970s and early 80s during the nuclear era. But that's the share of primary energy. Since global energy consumption continues to rise, we haven't reached a peak in emissions for fossil fuel consumption yet. Those numbers are still rising. They're rising more slowly than they used to, but they're still rising. And what's happening is that the gap between fossil fuel use and renewable energy is beginning to close. It should start to close more rapidly now, given for the fourth year in a row, I think, transition spending has outstripped traditional fossil fuel spending in 2-to-1, 3-to-1, whatever the ratio is. So this gap should continue to close, but it's going to take a long time to close. And one of the primary takeaways that we get every year, in particular this year, is if natural gas is going to be around for a long time, and we think it will, and it's also impossible to conceive of and understand human prosperity right at this point without the contribution from natural gas, that system is going to need investment and to make sure it can be delivered safely, and its methane footprint is going to have to be managed more closely. But there's no question, when you look at the numbers, that natural gas is going to be a critical part of human prosperity for a very long time. And here's one of the reasons why. We have a chart here that shows the two major things going on. There's electrification of the grid, and then there's how much are we using the grid. So the green line here is the electrification of the grid. These are global numbers. And the grid is greenifying rapidly now with all the wind and mostly solar buildouts taking place around the world. We're now over 30% globally of electricity generation coming from renewables. And that number is rising, you know, quickly. What's not rising very quickly is the electricity share of global energy consumption. What are we using electricity for? So to put it in clear terms, what's happening quickly is the energy that we're consuming for air conditioning, space cooling, computers, data centers, things like that, that's becoming greener. But the uses of electricity in the broad economy are rising very, very slowly. And the electrification share of the global economy hasn't even risen 5% in the last 10 years. So that's a very, very slow process. And this year we look at why. Now, electrovision is this vision that we spell out in the executive summary. And what would that roadmap look like for the U.S.? Well, it's primarily based on the notion that electric vehicles using electric motors and electric heat pumps are more efficient than their fossil fuel counterparts. In other words, EV motors are 90% efficient compared to something between around 25 and 30% for internal combustion engines for vehicles. And electric heat pumps are much more efficient than their furnace and boiler counterparts for winter heating. So if you can electrify, you can actually shrink your energy footprint at the same time you decarbonize. So here we have a chart that's one of the main focal points of the piece, which is, okay, we start out where we are now. We decarbonize the current grid by adding more wind and solar. We decarbonize road transportation with the EV cars and trucks. And then we decarbonize winter heating with residential and commercial heat pumps. And then we decarbonize some amount of industrial production with industrial heat pumps. It all sounds very straightforward. And again, from a mechanical engineering perspective, it can work. The issues are all around cost, implementation, chemistry, and physics, and other things. And here's a summary of what it would take. We have a table here that looks at the current situation for the U.S. and what electrovision would entail. And it's a pretty big difference. What you have is around a 33% decline. A third, fossil fuel usage would fall by a third. But in order to accomplish this, you'd have to grow the grid enormously. And so just to put some numbers around this, the increase in electricity generation in the United States would be of a magnitude that where it last happened over 30 years. So in other words, the grid expansion necessary took us 30 years last time to accomplish. More than 50% of this grid would have to be intermittent and would need sufficient either battery storage or peaker plants to accommodate. We'd need a 400% increase in wind and solar power. There'd be a massive build out of transmission and distribution, which has been a major challenge. I think that even today, the costs of all this would be underestimated because of the duplication of infrastructure. There's very poor technological readiness of long duration energy storage. And we have a very slow replacement rate for vehicles, furnaces, and other combustion equipment right now. And then the other issue, of course, is the fact that electricity costs a lot more than natural gas per unit of energy. So the executive summary gets into the vision of electrovision and then some of the constraints and a discussion of how long it might take. Here I'm showing the table of contents. So in addition to that discussion about electrification, we have a link to Vaclav's latest essay. We have a section on China, which is the world's largest energy user, which is building lots of everything. Coal, wind, solar, nuclear, hydro, you name it, they're building a lot of everything. We have a section, which I think is very important, with four pages of essential energy transition charts on a wide variety of topics that we update each year. We have a section on the investment returns on oil and gas, renewables, and nuclear shares. And then we have a section on nuclear power. How much does it cost? Really hard to tell. We get into the details. But then we also talk about the consequences of decommissioning existing nuclear, both in Germany and in New York State. I take another swing at Lazard for their sloppy levelized cost analysis, which we did last year. We have some of the last, we have a section on some advanced electrification topics, mostly related to the concentration of load associated with people all charging or heating their homes at the same time once they're electrified. We have a section on why you should probably skip any article you read that talks about how wonderful things are going in what I call the punies, which are the small countries with unique natural resource attributes. PUNY stands for Panama, Uruguay, Namibia, and Iceland. We have a section on net zero oil, which is which I hadn't heard of, and then I did some work on it. Occidental Petroleum is basically trying to continue to produce traditional oil that gets combusted and then separately use direct air carbon capture to offset the carbon footprint of that combusted oil. It sounds simple. The details are not so simple. We go through the details. I'm deeply skeptical of anything based on direct air carbon capture, but I will keep an open mind to see what happens. Similarly, we have a section on something called bio oil. JP Morgan, as a firm, contracted with a company to sequester bio oil from pyrolysis of corn stover. It's another kind of highly manual, labor-intensive approach to decarbonization. We talk about that. And then at the end, we have a thought experiment on the reconstruction of Gaza and the role that distributed solar power might play with some history that goes back to World War I and World War II. And I'm not going to get into too much details. I think that section is better read in its entirety than for me trying to summarize it. And then we close with some charts on energy supply and demand, the global LNG markets, and then a must-read one-pager on all the misadventures that are going on with Electrify America, Waymo, and my Jeep, my woeful Jeep hybrid. So here's just a few charts that I want to walk through before closing. The big issue with electrification of vehicles and winter heating is just the time it takes to replace these combustion devices. In the United States, we're now up to roughly a 10% share of battery electric and plug-in hybrids as a percentage of total sales. As a share of the fleet, it's still around 2%. So both of those numbers are going to rise over time, but it's going to take a lot longer for the share of fleet numbers than the share of sales numbers. And then in the United States and in Europe, house new home construction every year is less than 1% of the stock of existing homes. Why does that matter? Most of the time, if we're relying on transition to heat pumps away from furnaces and natural gas heating systems, most of the time that takes place when new homes get built. But that's a very, very, very slow process. So without the right kind of subsidies and training and equipment availability, that's also going to be a very, very, very slow process. And then the thing one of the things I'm very skeptical of is there's a lot of hockey stick forecasts that industrial energy use is going to be electrified. Here you can see industrial energy use of electricity as a share of total electricity use has been stagnant for 40 years. So, and there's a variety of physical and chemical reasons for that, which we discuss in the paper. But even before you get into those, anything that hasn't changed for 40 years, you should be very skeptical of when people tell you that it's going to change overnight in a meaningful way. And then Electrovision is heavily reliant on transmission, right? We have to move these electrons around. This transmission line growth is growing in the wrong direction. This is the anti-Electrovision chart that's going on in the United States. Okay. We have a chart here that shows the new gigawatt miles of transmission line growth added every year. And that number is falling quite sharply rather than rising for political reasons, NIMBY reasons, all sorts of stuff. And so Electrovision is going to be almost impossible to accomplish unless that number starts to go up. The cost of the transition, when people ask me how much the transition might cost, I show them this chart, which is if you add a megawatt of wind or solar, how much natural gas can you unplug, right? Because if you can't unplug, if you can unplug 1 megawatt for 1 megawatt, then maybe it doesn't cost so much. but that's not the case. So the ISOs, the independent system operators, provide data so that we can estimate this. And roughly, you can only decommission or unplug 10 to 25% at most every time you add a megawatt. So you add a megawatt of wind and solar, you can decommission 20% of that number in terms of natural gas capacity, because you still have to keep most of it around. Now, you don't use it as much, and so its capacity factor goes down, but you still have to build it and you still have to maintain it. And so this essential, this duplication of infrastructure is a big part of why the transition itself is inherently inflationary. In terms of nuclear, there's been so much discussion about nuclear over the last 18 months. How much would it cost to build a new plant? Who knows? There have been so few plants built in the Western world in the last 30 years, just a handful. And unfortunately, the four examples of the ones that were built and completed all came in billions and billions of dollars over budget and many, many years late, whether it's the U.S. plant in Georgia, Flamanville in France, Hinkley Point in the U.K., and one of the plants in Finland. And in emerging economies, primarily Russia, China, and India, these plants are getting completed between 6 and 7 years, sometimes 8 years. But what can be accomplished in China, India, and Russia has no bearing or parallel to what it would take to do in the West for all the obvious regulatory and other reasons. So the West has announced its intention for a nuclear renaissance. I mean, even if it got jump-started today, it could easily take 10 to 15 years to materialize, and the cost could be staggeringly high if the recent plant completions are any indication. That said, decommissioning existing nuclear is a very challenging thing that can have negative outcomes. We have a couple of charts in here, one on Germany, one on New York State. Germany decommissioned almost all of its nuclear right before Russia invaded Ukraine. And as a result, its dependence on imported liquefied natural gas was massive and magnified. And one of the analyses that we did was we said, what's the counterfactual? Suppose Germany didn't decommission all that nuclear power. Well, based on our number crunching, they would have needed 85% less natural gas at the time Russia invaded Ukraine had they just kept their nuclear plants online, which would have changed a lot of things in Germany and in Europe about its response to the invasion. And then in New York State, the shutdown of Indian Point, New York City and Long Island used to have one of the best carbon footprints in the country. NYSERDA and some other New York agencies said, well, don't worry, we're going to shut down Indian Point, and we're going to add a combination of wind, solar, and hydro to make up the gap. So far, that's not happening. And now New York has a higher carbon footprint than the rest of the U.S. because of natural gas expansion and imports of electricity from neighboring states like Pennsylvania that are based on natural gas. Now, maybe the completion of some of the Blackstone's building the Champlain Express from Canada, that'll offset part of this. But while it's very expensive and difficult to build new plants, decommissioning existing ones need to be done very carefully. And then the last couple of comments, we have a chart every year that looks at energy independence. After 40 years, I remember as a kid in the early 1970s, when parents used to line up to get gas based on what the last digit of their license plate, Nixon was talking about the urgency of energy independence. 40 years later, the United States is finally entering Japan, while Europe and Japan and Europe and China compete for the same imports of natural resources. So the energy transition has to be done in a way that doesn't sacrifice this energy independence. And right now, there are too many supply chains that are still China reliant. And so, you know, that's what Manchin was trying to accomplish with some of his negotiations with Schumer on the energy bill. The Biden administration has basically steamrolled a lot of those Manchin concerns. And in the interpretations of the energy bill, they are going full steam ahead for decarbonization at the expense of, in my opinion, of national security, which is a balance that needs to be struck, I think, a little bit better. Last thing for investors, renewable energy stocks have gotten absolutely decimated since their peak in 2021. With the Fed pivot, I think the declines, the bleeding has stopped. the best thing to have owned over the last 3 years was a portfolio that was long traditional energy and short renewables. Those returns have now kind of converged. And at this point, I think you can make a good argument for owning both of them in your portfolio, except you should be aware of one thing, and I'll close with this. We have a chart in here that looks at operating margins by sector for clean energy, oil and gas, healthcare, tech, software, telecom, cyber, robotics, fintech. In other words, how profitable are renewable energy companies right now, even with the subsidies they get, compared to the traditional energy sector and a bunch of other stuff that people see as growth stocks? And the answer is they're not very profitable. The six indices that we're showing generally have operating margins below 10%, which is not very growthy. Below most of the rest of the comparables that we showed here and below the traditional energy sector. So I think it's important for investors to understand these are capital intensive businesses that are very subsidy reliant, and that even with the benefit of that, there's still not enough profitability to go around. So that's the end of the podcast. Thank you for listening. The paper is best digested, you know, over a long, snowy weekend, someplace where nobody's bothering you. And thanks for listening. Thanks for reading. And I'll see you again on this paper next year, a year from today. Bye.
Michael Semblis, Eye on the Market, offers a unique perspective on the economy, current events, markets, and investment portfolios, and is a production of J.P. Morgan Asset and Wealth Management. Michael Semblis is the chairman of market and investment strategy for J.P. Morgan Asset Management and is one of our most renowned and provocative speakers. For more information, please subscribe to the Eye on the Market by contacting your J.P. Morgan representative. If you'd like to hear more, please explore episodes on iTunes or on our website. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and is a communication on behalf of J.P. Morgan Institutional Investments Incorporated. Views may not be suitable for all investors and are not intended.